This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We start the weekly news review with an update on the legal case against Cincinnati City Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld and a look at the affordable housing ballot measure in the city. We're joined now via Zoom by Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
Our pleasure to have you, Chris. And joining us in a socially distanced studio is Cincinnati Edition assistant producer Nick Swartzel. Nick, thanks for taking the time.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure to have you as well, Nick. Let's set the stage here with this affordable housing ballot measure. It's been quite controversial with city leaders, but for advocates of affordable housing in this city, which we know the city and the county lack a lot of affordable housing units, this is a big deal. So tell us again what it is and why these advocates support it.
So this is a ballot amendment that would require the city to put aside $50 million a year specifically for affordable housing. And that's from the city. That's not including any federal funding or anything else. That money would go into an affordable housing trust fund that was created in 2018 and currently has about $1.5 million in it. Advocates of this measure say, look, you know, this 2017 study shows that we need 28,000 additional units of housing for low-income people in the city. And this is the way we get there. Council and, you know, City Hall haven't moved fast enough. We need to get this done.
And current members of City Council and those who are either exploring or have announced runs for council and certainly candidates for mayor have pushed back against this, right, Nick?
Many have, yes. There are a couple of mayoral contenders who have come out in support of it. But your big names have said they do not support this.
Chris Wetterich from the Business Courier. This week, Cincinnati City Council voted to change some wording related to this ballot measure, which will be up for voters' consideration in the May primary. What did they want to change?
Well, basically, they added a bunch of stuff, including that, you know, the original ballot language didn't actually say to voters that the amount that this would cost would be $50 million a year. They left that out. So the first thing they did in or put it in the first place, they have to come from services that we have now, police, fire, public works.
I think we've got a bit of a strange connection today, unfortunately. Usually Zoom works very well for us when we have our guests, but I think as everyone in our listening community understands, Zoom meetings can sometimes get a little frozen. So Chris, if you can still hear me, I'm going to ask our producer, Selena Reeder, to give you a call and we're going to get you on the phone because we've got lots to talk to you about. So go ahead and disconnect from the Zoom call. Selena Reeder is going to connect with you via phone and we're going to do it the old fashioned way. I'm getting a thumbs up from Josh Elster, our technical director. I want to make sure that is that the right thing I'm telling Chris? Okay. So yes, Chris, we are going to get you on the phone. I know all of you listening are sympathetic to this situation. We appreciate your patience as we try to connect via telephone rather than Zoom, which we find sounds better usually, but that's okay. A little bit of a weird connection today. We still have Nick Swartzel inside the studio, inside another studio. We're separated by glass. And so I think what Chris was starting to say there before he broke up on the connection was the city council made sure that voters, when they consider this in May, will know exactly how much it's going to cost each year, right?
Yeah, that was one of the additions is that they put that $50 million number in there. They stipulated, you know, that's going to have some impacts on the city's budget. They say this is what we need to do to let the public know what's in this thing. Advocates of the amendment say that some of the language is very opinionated. It's unfair. So they are going to, I believe, challenge this legally as it goes to the Board of Elections.
One piece of this, Nick, is that it would create a board, right? There'd be a new board?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Chris will be able to speak more of that. Yeah.
Oh, do we
I think there he is. Yeah.
Do we have Chris Wetterich back on the phone now? I think I'm seeing that he is. Is Chris Wetterich with us on the telephone now?
Hi, Michael.
Happy Friday, Chris. You know, we're at the end of the week, and so we're all just ready to get through this last hour of work so we can move on with our weekend. And I appreciate you being flexible while we reconnect with you. We were recapping what I believe you were trying to say before the Zoom connection got weak, and basically that the members of council want voters to know that this would cost $50 million each year. What would the city face financially if this were to pass, according to those council members?
Well, they would face major layoffs amongst the city workers, because they would, the theory or the belief is that they would have to take this money from already due in the city, which is, you know, basic services, police, fire, public works, et cetera, and move it into affordable housing. I believe that the manager projected a 13% across the board budget cut if this went through. Now, of course, the advocates of this say, you know, we offered up four, you know, we offered up four different sources of money where this could come from, and you wouldn't necessarily have to make the cuts that are being talked about here.
And I was just discussing with Nick, and you can fill in some of the gaps here, that this would include an 11-member board. But council, did they want some changes to the makeup of that board?
I don't know if they want – what they want people to know is that, at least through the language, is that the members of the commission would be basically appointed by outside parties, social service groups, housing groups. There will be two appointees from the president pro tem of city council, which is a person that's elected from the council members themselves. That's really noteworthy to me because it's an unusual way of appointing members. Usually the mayor or the city manager appoints board members that the city has for its boards and commissions. When you think about the Recreation Commission or the Park Board or the City Planning Commission, those people generally are appointed by the mayor or the city manager. So this is a major departure from that.
We're talking with Chris Wederich from the Cincinnati Business Courier, where he is a reporter and columnist. And we're also joined in the studio by WVXU Cincinnati Edition assistant producer Nick Swartzel. We'll continue to follow this affordable housing ballot measure. I know we'll be talking about it again before the May 4th election. Let's move on to Cincinnati City Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld, indicted last year on federal corruption charges, derailing his plans to run for mayor this year, a campaign that he has ended. He has been suspended from city council. He claims he's innocent and is fighting these charges. But Nick, this week, a federal judge did issue some problems for him in that quest to not face a trial, right?
Yeah. Shortly after the indictment, Sittenfeld's attorneys filed this motion to dismiss the charges. And basically what they said in that motion is like, look, the federal government here has not actually alleged corruption. The indictment doesn't spell out that there was a quid pro quo agreement between Sittenfeld and the FBI agents and undercover FBI agents and FBI informant that are involved in this case, which is about allegedly taking $40,000 in checks under the promise of some kind of official action on a development deal downtown. So that's what Sittenfeld's attorneys argued. The judge says, you know, actually, the federal government does allege quid pro quo here. There's a reasonable jury could find that there was quid pro quo in the indictment, and also points out that the federal government hasn't presented all of its evidence yet, and it's up to a jury to decide. So that's kind of the gist of the judge's filing.
Chris, obviously a blow to Councilman Sittenfeld's intent to have this rapidly put behind him.
Definitely. And then there were some choice quotes from the judge in there. This is actually a pretty readable decision, I have to say, as a layperson, you know, reading these things. Sometimes they devolve into lawyer speak and there's citations. But Judge Cole really did a good job kind of summing this up. One of the quotes that really stuck out to me is that he said, if there is one thing that everyone knows federal bribery law prohibits, it is agreeing to undertake official action in exchange for campaign contributions. So he was saying that, you know, clearly the allegations are such that there needs to be a trial. He also did say, in all fairness to Councilman Sittenfeld, that there are some things in the indictment that could be helpful to him, such as when he tells folks who's wired up against him that, you know, that he can't do anything legal, he wouldn't do anything illegal. And so the context of all that will be important, the judge said, but it's important that it will come out at a.
And we will obviously continue to follow that case as well, as it appears it will be ongoing. Nick Swartzel, thanks for taking some time to move from the other side of the mic to this side of the mic and chat with us a little bit. And we'll look forward to doing that again soon.
Thanks, Michael. Always love being here.
We'll continue now with Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wederich, who has a cover story out today at the Business Courier on whether City Hall is ready for the reforms. You heard us just now talking about Councilman Sittenfeld's arrest. He was the third member of City Council arrested last year on federal corruption charges. Tamaya Denard pleaded guilty and has been sentenced. Councilman Jeff Pastor also suspended from council after being arrested on federal corruption charges. So what's the answer, Chris? Is City Hall ready for reform? We know that the candidates, certainly the some who are already elected and some who are coming from the outside, are running on campaigns of reform.
Right, right. Well, they're certainly, because they're politicians, they're definitely ready to talk about reform. And one of the main reforms that we talk about in the story is this notion, I kind of think of it as the thou shalt not talk to developers reform, or at least not talk to them outside of city council chambers. This is a reform that Councilman David Mann floated early this year, and it's kind of out in the city bureaucracy. There's a supposedly a report that will come out, and there already has been some reports from the city manager about things that they could do to implement reforms. But this one, basically, you know, what Councilman Mann has proposed is basically that the council should only talk to a developer once an ordinance referring a benefit that the developer receives, whether it's a tax incentive or a zoning change or whatever. Once that is referred to council, at that point, only in council chambers could you speak with the developer. And the penalty if you do that, if you don't do that, I guess I should say, is there would be ethical violations for the council member involved, and that there could be the potential of a developer being barred from receiving city contracts going forward in case if either side violated those two. And there's some questions among the council members about the First Amendment implications of that. And it's a reform that is not yet passed, but is under discussion there.
We were talking earlier in this segment, Chris, about a ballot measure facing voters in Cincinnati in May related to affordable housing. Voters are also going to consider rules related to council members and their suspensions if they're indicted for crimes, right?
Right. There's two ballot measures. One is by Betsy Sunderman, the Republican councilwoman who replaced Amy Murray last year. It would allow a supermajority of council members to suspend one of their colleagues if they're indicted for crimes related to their duties as council members. So basically, that would have allowed council to suspend all three of the people that were indicted last year. As you know, they had to go through a lengthy court process. Initiated through the state attorney general to actually get that done. This would allow that process to happen in-house instead of at the state attorney general level.
What impact on this race that we've got this year? We've got a mayoral primary. We have a city council race, of course, later in the year, along with the final part of the mayor's race. With all of the candidates, or such a great deal of the candidates, talking about reform, how do you expect voters to discern between the nuances of these proposals?
You know, I think there are so many council candidates at this point. We were looking at I think it'd be a little bit confusing. I think, you know, personally, I'm going to be looking toward the mayoral candidates to see what they say. There's at least fewer of them. And I think we will hear more from the council candidates about this, but I think the focus on them is really not going to happen until, you know, basically after the May primary, when we know who the two mayoral candidates are going to be for the November general election.
And we won't know for sure the full council candidate field until a little later this year. And you reported this week that a pretty familiar name, not just to politics, but just sort of a Cincinnati iconic personality, is exploring a return to politics. Tell us.
Yeah, Jim Tarbell, the former owner of Arnold's, he owned the Ludlow Garage back in its heyday, although it's a concert venue again. You know, he was a councilman for four terms, and he's considering making a comeback. He's a charterite. You know, Tarbell was at a press conference announcing the charter committee's reforms. He's a longtime charterite. His dad was a charter member, and so he is considering making a comeback. He told us that he will not make a final decision until he's got his signatures. Those signatures, of course, are not due until August, but I would think that we'll know sooner than that, because both the Charter Committee and the Democratic Party will be seeing this spring a slate of candidates each.
I imagine in a crowded field like we typically have in city council election years, a name recognition situation like the one Tarbell would possess would be quite an advantage.
Yeah, I think that you're going to see this year. I mean, if you have I can't imagine we will actually have 85 people gather the sufficient signatures, but even if we only had half that, the people with name recognition are going to stick out amongst that field and kind of haze of names that people will see on their ballot. And that's going to be a huge advantage for him and for other people who may have run for council before or been council members. I think of Kevin Flynn, for one example, and I think of the incumbent councilman, Greg Landsman, the Democrat.
Chris Wederich is a reporter and columnist at the Cincinnati Business Courier. Chris, we always love having you on Fridays, even when it's a little hard to understand and we get a little disconnected. But great to have you on, and I hope you have a really good weekend.
You too. Thanks, Michael.
And we do apologize for those connection difficulties that seem to follow from the Zoom call to the phone call. Chris is so great, and we love having him on, and he's so good at reporting and explaining things to us. But we know that next time we get him on, it will be a clearer connection, so we thank him. Up next, Governor Mike DeWine offers a hint at when the mask mandate in the state of Ohio could be lifted. That part was Josh Elstrow's fault, I should point out. So I just want to point that. That was not Chris's fault. That was Josh Elstrow. It's Friday. We've made it. And so up next, we've got Governor Mike DeWine offering a hint at when the mask mandate in the state could be lifted. And later, why WVXU uses the word wreck in our traffic reports. I'm feeling a little wrecky myself right now. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. I think we've got our act together now. We apologize for those technical difficulties that we had in the first segment. And we will move on now, turning to Columbus. And joining us are Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Karen, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So good to hear from you. And we also have the reporter from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Joe Ingles. Joe, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Indeed. So, Karen, Joe, it's been about a year since I think we first talked about the Arnold Sports Festival, that first major event that did not happen because of something called a coronavirus. And here we are a year later still dealing with this. We've all gotten accustomed to wearing masks in public and that sort of thing. Governor Mike DeWine offered his third statewide primetime address during this pandemic just yesterday. Karen, tell us what he said, particularly as it relates to those masks, because we are seeing governors across the country start to lift that mandate.
Well, it was interesting. And my colleague Joe Ingles on the line here was actually the one who followed the governor's address last night. But you're right, it was his third primetime address. And he's been doing those, I think, to try to draw attention to certain things that he wants people to know about. He doesn't make major policy announcements in those. And I think this was an address to really remind people that the pandemic's not over. We have more vaccines, our numbers are dropping, but the pandemic is not over. And even though states like Texas and Mississippi are lifting mask mandates, that doesn't mean that Ohio was going to follow suit. His spokesperson said earlier in the week that that was not going to be the case. And Dwight actually laid out the timeline potentially for lifting the mask mandate and other health orders, saying that if there are basically, as Joe did the math there, 50 cases per 100 per 10,000 people for 2 weeks, that translates to 5,950 cases over a 2 week period, 425 cases a day. Just to put that in perspective, the last time we were that low was June 17th. When there were 392 confirmed cases. That started a summer swing that we had a surge, and then it went back down again, and then went back up again. So it's been a long time since we've been at this level, but it seemed like DeWine was trying to offer some hope that at some point, the orders will lift, the mask mandate will be gone, and life will return to whatever normal will be then.
So we are starting to see cases decline again across the country. And we are also seeing more vaccines being distributed, and people are exploring the relationship between those timelines. And Joe, let me bring you in now. What are we seeing on the vaccine front in Ohio?
Well, this week we saw a lot more vaccines. We saw a ton of vaccines coming in from the Johnson & Johnson vaccines that were just approved last weekend. Plus, we saw the vaccines that we are normally getting from Moderna and Pfizer. So all of that, and the fact that some of the older populations were starting to get in and they were finding spots to get vaccinated, all of that played into the governor's mind earlier this week, and he expanded eligibility. So now anyone 60 or over, people who have like type 1 diabetes, pregnant people who've had a bone marrow transplant, people in certain occupations like police who have been lobbying for a while to be able to get vaccines, they can get it. Corrections officers, child care. So all of these people have been added in, and you know, I'm starting to see a lot of people are getting the vaccine. You know, it was for a while there one of those situations where you just see people complain that they couldn't get in, And you're still getting that with some people, but a lot of people are getting in, and a lot of people are getting vaccines now. So it's very encouraging, actually. This week has been hopeful on the vaccine front. That And we also had the news coming from President Biden that he said that there will be enough vaccine at the end of May for anyone who wants one. So, you know, all of that makes us hopeful right now.
Indeed, it does. And yes, the president did say that we would have enough vaccines in this country for all of us to have received one by May. Does that seem to be supported by what we're seeing in Ohio so far? I mean, what would those numbers look like here? Do we know?
Well, we don't really know the numbers, but certainly if we're continuing to see this increase, and let's not forget that Johnson & Johnson asked a rival, Merck, who was in the vaccine, they were trying to get their own vaccine together early on, and that kind of failed. So they've asked Merck to come in. Merck is going to help ramp up production. So they're doing a lot of things to try to get more vaccine to more people. Governor DeWine just today, I think he's going to announce that we're going to start seeing these mass vaccination sites where you take over an arena or a field or a big place and have vaccinations, a lot of them at once. When we start seeing that, and when you start seeing your neighbors and people around you being vaccinated, it will definitely be proof that we are ramping up toward that goal.
Let me add something here real quick. DeWine has just announced today he's up in Cleveland on the campus of Cleveland State at the Wallstein Center, which is a convention center type facility, that the state will start a 8-week mass vaccination clinic there that has the ability to vaccinate 6,000 people a day. This is one of two clinics that FEMA is operating and has just announced today. One in Cleveland and one in Atlanta. And I think the idea of both those clinics is not only what Joe's saying, to really show that there's a ramp up here and to get those vaccines into arms, but also to try to reach out to communities that have been left out of this. Northeast Ohio site, of the people that live nearby, about 45% of those people are in poverty. And so the idea is to try to reach people who are above 60 and also people who have potentially not had the opportunity to get the vaccine because they're not able to, they don't have the access to the internet to make the appointments and that sort of thing.
We're talking with Karen Kassler and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Joe, weeks ago, it was discovered that more than 4,000 COVID-19 deaths in Ohio were not recorded properly. So a change has been made in that respect. What can you tell us about that?
Well, right off the bat, they made some administrative changes over at the Ohio Department of Health in reaction to that. Basically, the person who was supposed to be doing reconciliation got behind over the holiday period, you know, around Thanksgiving, Christmas, that period of time, kind of got behind in that reconciliation process. And that's how they ended up with the 4,000 deaths that weren't recorded. But then they went back in and they saw, what were they doing or not doing that was, you know, systematic that they could make changes? So one of the things that they have done this week is they are moving away from that reconciliation process and moving into sheer data. Now, the reason they started doing this reconciliation to begin was they wanted to make it so that they could report the deaths faster. Because anyone who's got a death certificate going through that process, you know it takes a while to process a death certificate. get it out there earlier. So they were basically circumventing the system a little bit to try to get that count in there earlier. But that's what was all bogged up. So now they're going to deal with the data and they're going to deal with the death certificates after they've been processed. And so it might make it so that the death data comes in slower. But really, the death data is kind of the last part of the process anyway. Hospitalizations and positivity rates and other factors give you much more information about how the COVID pandemic is progressing. And so you want to keep your eye on those. And so this is supposed to, this new system that they're doing is supposed to actually make it more accurate.
Karen, there was some other good news on the COVID front in Ohio. I understand you took in some hockey this week.
I did. I was in the press box for the first Columbus Blue Jackets game that featured fans in 366 days. And this was really exciting for the 1,953 people who were able to come in and see the game. Attendance was at 10% of capacity. Now, on that same day, Tuesday, Governor DeWine signed an executive order that allows for a boost in capacity for indoor sports to 25% of seating, and then for outdoor sports to 30%. So this really does suggest that things are moving forward, especially in these areas where we haven't seen activity in over a year. I mean, Major League Hockey shut down on March 12th. But Blue Jackets were on the road, so their last game was before that, their last home game anyway. So this is an exciting development, I think, for a lot of sports fans who have really missed that energy. But the question then, of course, becomes, what about the arts? What about theater, movie theaters, and other activities that are done indoors? And I think, you know, we've got a long way to go, unfortunately. But it was a really great game. And, hey, fans there helped snap the Blue Jackets losing streak.
Well, just tell me personally, if you don't mind, I mean, what did it feel like being back in an arena like that after,
oh,
you know, not having the opportunity for so long?
Well, I'm a huge hockey fan, first of all. And I was there during the playoff chase in 2019 when Nationwide Arena was one of the loudest places in the NHL. So to compare that wall of sound that 19,000 people produced then to the sound that a little over 1,900 people were able to produce this time, it was weird. It was different. And I was talking to some other journalists who were there, who've been there all along covering sports, and they said it was really strange when there were no fans there. And so to have at least some fans back puts it a little bit more toward normal. It's still weird, but we're getting closer to whatever, again, the new normal is going to be. And so it's a good move, but I was just really happy to be back and happy to talk to some people again. We don't get out much now. All of our stuff is done on Zoom and everything, like with your situation. So you start to miss people.
You really do. And I'm just so optimistic again, you know, now that you start to see little things like this and little signs that whatever normal will look like is starting to emerge. And we are excited about that. Couldn't let you all be on the program, though, without redirecting the conversation a little bit to that nuclear power plant bailout law, which you all so expertly cover at Ohio Public Radio. Karen, there was a change, I guess, in the state Senate related to this nuclear power plant bailout law.
Yeah, this is one of two bills that have passed that the Senate has done that tries to chip away at what is known as House Bill 6, which is the sweeping energy law that bails out Ohio's two nuclear power plants, also bails out two coal-fired power plants. It strips away requirements on renewable energy and energy efficiency programs that utilities were running. This that you're talking about this week, though, specifically would take away the subsidies to Ohio's two nuclear power plants that all Ohio electric ratepayers were going to be paying. That was supposed to happen in January. We were all supposed to see those subsidies and those fees starting to come onto our electric bills. There are two court orders that are holding that back. And so what the Senate is trying to do now is take away those subsidies because Energy Harbor, which used to be First Energy Solutions, which used to be a part of First Energy, Energy Harbor now says they're out of bankruptcy and they don't need the subsidies anymore, which is a huge change because for years those two nuclear power plants had said that they needed state help to keep running. And now, because of federal action and their bankruptcy proceedings, Energy Harbor says they don't need the money anymore. But all of this is wrapped up with the federal case involving former Speaker Larry Householder, four other people, a dark money group, and a utility widely believed to be First Energy. We expect to see some action on that in the federal court sometime this year because of the corruption trial that all of these entities are involved in. Two people in that have pleaded guilty so far, so it's moving forward.
Read more on that story and all these stories from Ohio Public Radio at statenews.org. That's statenews.org. Let's just turn quickly to federal politics. Of course, Ohio Republican Congressman Anthony Gonzalez was among those Republicans who voted to impeach President Trump. And as we're seeing across the country, related to those specific Republicans, they are facing significant backlash, not the least of which is coming from former President Trump himself. This week, Joe, we saw Donald Trump turn his ire at Anthony Gonzalez. And I understand that Senator Rob Portman, though, a fellow Republican here in Ohio, says he doesn't want Gonzalez to resign.
Yeah, I mean, he said that Gonzalez is a good legislator, a good person. He doesn't think there's any reason for him to resign. He's backing him. But let's remember that Rob Portman is not going to run for re-election next year.
Yes, let's remember that while the two people who are running for the Republican nomination are doing everything they can to cater to Trump's base.
Exactly. And Jane Timken, earlier, right after the impeachment happened, she wasn't coming down hard on Gonzalez for the vote. She still stood behind him. And even though she disagreed with the vote, you know, she was behind him. But now she's saying she's against it, too. So he's got, you know, the funny thing is there right there after the impeachment vote, I think a lot of Republicans were kind of figuring out, where does Donald Trump play into all this? And I think what we've seen in the last 3 or 4 weeks is that Donald Trump is still the leader of the Republican Party.
Indeed. Joe Ingles, Karen Kastler from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We always love having you on. I'm glad that we had no interruptions technically to our conversation in that particular segment after a rocky start to today's program. Thanks to both of you for spending part of your Friday with us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with Cincinnati Inquirer Chief Concrete Correspondent Scott Wartman, who joins us via Zoom. Scott, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
You know, you had quite a good story this week, very in-depth, and I have to say I was a little surprised. This thing is still going on. I'm talking about that Hilltop Concrete plant on the riverfront, which we talked about at length on this program. I think even with conversations involving you, Scott, there's still work left to do in order to move the work forward. So first, tell us again what that work is. What is the ultimate goal for that site where that concrete plant is near Paul Brown Stadium?
Yes. Well, this may be the most important concrete plant in the country. I'm not sure I know of another that's getting or has gotten as much attention the past 2 years than this 17-acre concrete plant right by Paul Brown Stadium. The ultimate goal is this would simply just be a parking lot. But I mean, why that's important without the county purchasing this concrete plant, the music venue, which is built in the shadow of Paul Brown Stadium on the other side, wouldn't have happened. The Bengals had the development veto rights for the property around the stadium, and they said, well, if you build right here where we have tailgating and parking, you need to give us another lot. So the county agreed to purchase this plant. The problem with it is relocating a concrete plant is really difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine that there's a very particular type of real estate necessary for that.
Yes. It's, well, for one thing, the company itself, they need to have access. It's got to be along the river because barges bring in gravel and aggregate and the raw materials to make concrete. They want to be relatively close to downtown. So you got to have a property that meets those specifications, plus a place where the neighbors are like, okay, well, we don't mind a concrete plant moving next to us, which is not, there aren't too many places like that. They tried to move to Lower Price Hill, Queensgate area, which is already industrial. It seemed like a good fit, but that they encountered a pretty chilly reception there from the city leaders, the mayor, and the residents that are there. So that plan was eventually abandoned. So the CEO is looking at property on both sides of the river right now, but they can't tell me how close they are to a deal. It might be this year, it might be next year, who knows?
Yeah, that I want to cite part of your reporting verbatim here. Quote, no one has tallied the final cost with interest payments to the taxpayers beyond the $30 million the county agreed to pay Hilltop for the 17-acre mm-hmm. site. The county has only purchased a little less than half the land for $12 million. You go on to write, proceeds from the 0.5% sales tax voter approved in 1996 to build the two riverfront stadiums will pay for the purchase, and then neither Hilltop nor the county could say when the deal would get done, though county officials said they hope to close on the property sometime this year. So we still don't have a timeline, right?
No. I mean, the county has bought about 7 acres of the 17-acre property, which will be used for parking when the Bengals season starts. It's basically just a gravel lot. It right by a giant gravel pile, actually, which the factory uses to make the concrete. So it's not a very scenic lot or anything like that, but it'll be functional to meet the basic requirements that the county has to give the Bengals per the agreement that they signed 23 years ago when they leased the stadium.
We know that last year during the election for Hamilton County Commission, then candidate Alicia Reese had expressed some concerns about this deal. Now she is a commissioner after winning that election. What thoughts has she shared lately on it?
She has not come around to it. She still doesn't like the deal. Chiefly, her big main complaint or concern is that the county is going to be purchasing this property for potentially this company to move out of the county, therefore taking this 70 employees work at the factory there. So taking all the taxes, the payroll taxes, and just downtown workers with it wherever it locates. I mean, there's still a chance they could locate still in Hamilton County, but again, it's a matter of finding the rare property that can fit, you know, the needs of the not only the company, but the neighbors and the residents of wherever it locates.
So we know that Hilltop moved its corporate office to River Center and on the Covington Riverfront, so they can see the concrete plant, of course, probably from their office windows and those two towers there that you see on the Covington Riverfront. And you did report that the company has identified potential sites on both sides of the river. I guess with the corporate headquarters moving to Covington, you at least get the indication that they plan to stay in the vicinity somewhere.
Well, yeah, they said they have to be close to downtown. A lot of pretty much, I mean, I can't say all, but I mean, I think a majority of like construction projects in the Cincinnati area uses Hilltop concrete. I mean, they're it's a major operation. It's a big company. They have factories elsewhere also, but this is a big part of their operations. They've been on their this factory, which it's kind of odd that this factory is still there. It's a vestige of when the riverfront was used for warehouse industry. They've been there since the 40s or 50s. They actually had to move to their current location when the city built Riverfront Stadium. That was their original location on the river. So they're used to moving for riverfront projects, but they want to still be close to downtown because a lot of the projects that use their concrete are in the downtown area.
And just to reiterate, because listeners are probably wondering why the county would risk losing dozens, 70 employees, if it does move to a different part of the region outside of Hamilton County to put in a parking lot. And this is related to the agreement involving the Bengals. They need a minimum number of parking spaces on the game day per the lease that they signed with the county to use Paul Brown Stadium.
Correct. Yeah. And the numbers changed a little bit over the years. It's gone from like 3,200 to 5,000. 2,000. Right now, the county has to maintain about 3,200 parking spaces on game days for the Bengals to, you know, have parking and tailgating. And again, the reason why they want to turn this lot specifically into parking was they wanted to build a music venue, and in order to build it where the county wanted it, they had to get the Bengals on board, and the Bengals like, well, you got to offset the parking we're going to lose. So, and the original plan real quickly was going to be this really pretty green parking lot with grass and trees.
I'm looking at the image that you included in your article, Scott. It's a really beautiful rendering of a green parking lot.
That may not happen though. Now with the, since the pandemic, parking is not really, the demand isn't there like it was in 2019. So the county's reevaluating exactly what the final product's going to look like. So we don't know at this point. And there's also the possibility it's in the agreement with the Bengals. If the Bengals at their own cost, at the team's cost, want an indoor practice facility, they'll be able to use this land to build an indoor practice facility. The team hasn't expressed indications that they are going to do that yet, but it is an option in the future.
And before we let you run to get on with your weekend, Scott Wortman, let me ask you about a reference to Cincinnati on Fox News, Tucker Carlson's show. We know it's not uncommon for Fox News opinion host to target Democrat-run cities in a negative way, to say, look at how terribly run these cities are by Democrats. But Cincinnati got a positive shout-out on his show this week.
It was a rare instance where you saw a political pundit on TV actually concede a point. He had a local, a Cincinnati native, a Sycamore High School graduate who has traveled around the world as an international attorney and a State Department official, David Tafuri. He's a regular guest on Fox News. And Tucker just was like, hey, name me a city that Democrats have improved. And David said, Cincinnati. And Tucker's like, yeah, I'll give you that. It's a nice town. So, so there's that.
It's a nice town, Tucker Carlson. Put it on a billboard. Scott Wortman from the Cincinnati Inquirer, thank you so much for spending part of your Friday with us. I hope you have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks for having me.
All right. There are a few single words used on our air here that seem to get more listener feedback than how we describe traffic incidents. So here with us is WVXU News Director and Morning Edition host Mary Ann Zalesnik to explain why we say wreck. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to have you on to clear this up. You finally had to write a column about this for the website. It's No Accident, Why We Say Wreck, because we get a ton of emails and calls about the way we characterize things that happen on the roads.
It is true. And stunningly, you know, I get a lot of email from listeners, sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes questions. But the thing I get the most email about at all, of all the things, is how we describe our traffic reporting.
And we sometimes have to laugh a little bit internally when you get some emails complaining about the new word we've chosen to use, right?
That is true. We use wreck. It all started because we for years, and it wasn't just us, everybody called these things accidents. I mean, I think that was pretty standard for decades. And after a while, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, we started getting email from people saying nothing's an accident. If you are driving too fast, maybe that's why this happened. Or maybe you weren't paying attention or you were texting or whatever. The tree didn't jump out in front of you. You did something to go hit the tree. Well, what if it was icy? Well, you slid on the ice, but the problem isn't that. It was you were driving too fast for conditions. So there's been a lot of talk to please change that. And the suggested word was crash. But I had problems with crash because I can't get out of my head that old Batman TV show with Adam West. And if those of you that are old enough to remember, there was the picture they'd put up when they were having a big fight. And on the screen, you'd see crash, pow, bang. And it just seemed difficult. So we brainstormed in the newsroom when we came up with wreck.
And like I was suggesting, I mean, I've even seen a few calls or emails about wreck.
Yeah, people. One woman actually called me very upset and said it would make women feel bad because they sometimes will describe their hair as a wreck, and therefore we're comparing them to cars. And somebody else said saying wreck makes us sound uneducated. Somebody else said it makes the city sound like a giant junkyard. Other people are so thrilled we're not using accident that they are very happy that we're using something separate from accident and are satisfied with that. But it's really, once I did a column, it's on our website at WVXU.org. And since the column ran, I've gotten more emails than I could tell you about with concerns.
Did not see that coming. I want to read one that you shared with us. Just asking to soften the rhetoric and make the announcement correspond to what actually transpired. You know, people might not understand how you report the traffic. And traffic, especially during the morning and then later in the afternoon, it's an incredibly important part of what radio does because people are listening in their cars. And so you want to alert them if there's a slowdown ahead. And the fact is, you don't often know much of the circumstances about why we're getting a certain alert through the traffic system, right? I mean,
that's absolutely right. I don't have time to go look at the cameras myself, frankly. I'm doing a lot of other things, which is why we have the service. And the information will come in and they always say accident. So whenever I see it on my screen, I have to immediately translate accident to wreck, which has its own troubles. And sometimes I slip and read what's there. But we don't know what's going on. Now, if they say there's a jackknife semi, I will say there's a jackknife semi. But frequently, I have no idea what's causing the problem. But we want to alert people as quickly as we can so they can get out of it or not get into it in the first place.
And of course, our friend Bill Reinhardt, who hosts the afternoon show, All Things Considered here, he's famous for his variation on traffic reports. But I mean, even he's made the adjustment.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I must put in a little, everyone loves the way Bill reports the debris in the road and his long pause to tell everybody what it is. I must say in the morning, the person who provides me with for the traffic service, all they ever tell me is there's debris in the road. I almost never know what it is. So
you don't get to say something fun like there's a mattress.
I don't. No, yeah. I very rarely. Once I think I got a cow, but that was it.
Well, before I let you run, though, I mean, you've been in journalism for a long time and language is important to us in broadcasting, and it does evolve.
I can't hear you. Oh, there we go.
Oh,
sorry about
that's
that.
Okay. I was describing the show as a wreck today. We've had some technical problems throughout, but I know our listeners are sympathetic because it's a pandemic. And
it's a wreck, Michael.
It is an absolute wreck. There's something
kidding,
in the roadway.
Kidding,
it's
kidding.
This show today.
No.
Yes, but we have to be conscious of language's evolution as we learn more about being sympathetic, empathetic, and sensitive to people and issues.
Absolutely true. One of the other things that came up is when there's a car that's not working in the road, that used to be described as a disabled vehicle. And I got a lot of calls from many people who felt that this was offensive to people who are physically or mentally disabled. So we immediately call those broken down vehicles now instead. And the person that called and was concerned about it actually pointed out to me, it's the same number of syllables, so it doesn't take any extra time.
No extra breath at all in reporting that. That's clever of people to let us know that. And people will let us know when they
yes,
think
they
we
will.
Can do better. And we appreciate that. I've learned so much from you in the 2 years I've been here, but one is to make sure that you always engage with people who reach out to you. So that is a lesson I take to heart, and I know that our listeners appreciate when you get back to them, and we even learn from them.
Well, thank you so much for letting me be here, and take a look at the column, anybody that wants to hear more about it.
WVXU.org is the place to go to read that column and all of the day's news, WVXU.org. Well, we've made it to Friday. Well done, everyone. Thank you for spending so much of your week with Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. This theme music composed by Rob Fetters. You can also find archives of our program at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.